Ready to proceed with the next case today. Again, I'm Michael Givens, Chief Judge of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left, Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. We're switching gears here now to a criminal case, Andrew Young versus the State of Nevada. The appellant raised 12 issues in the opening brief, and arguments, as you already heard, are only 15 minutes, so you can't cover 12 issues in 15 minutes. It's impossible. At least I've never seen it done. So we sent out an order scheduling this argument here at Boyd, and we included the following paragraph in this order. While the parties should be prepared to and may address any issues raised in this appeal, the parties should be prepared to focus on the following issue: whether the district court abused its discretion in refusing to remove a juror for bias when the juror stated that he wanted to reimburse the victims for their losses but would remain impartial throughout the trial. So that was one of the 12 issues that was raised in this case, and so counsel will be discussing that and probably some other points too. But that occasionally happens where the court gives some sort of direction. You heard it from the last attorneys that you have to prepare for everything, but you also have to be flexible and see what's happening during the argument and adjust your argument accordingly. So counsel in this case have the benefit of having received this order from our court that included that particular issue, so they know we want to hear some argument on that particular one, and we didn't want to have it overlooked in the 12-issue case. So that's where we are today. We have today for the appellant, Jason Margolis. Margolis? How do you pronounce your last name?
Did a perfect job.
Margolis. All right, for the appellant, Mr. Young, and we have for the respondent, the State of Nevada, Parker Brooks.
And
no trouble with your name. So this case was prosecuted here in Clark County, and we generally put our oral arguments where the case arose, so the vast majority of them are heard in Clark County, and then I'm not sure if the two of you were here for our introduction on the last case. We talked about how special counsel were. They got to argue at Boyd. Well, we think it's special. And you saw what happened at the end. We're hoping that you can stick around for a few minutes and explain to the students and faculty here briefly your experience, how it might relate to what they want to do. If you do trial work, appellate work, you know, how you got here, and importantly, too, what do you think about arguing a case at Boyd, so outside of a normal courtroom? So those are just a few points to consider for the end of the proceedings today. So just like in the last case, the appellant gets 15 minutes. So does the respondent. The appellant can reserve time for rebuttal. Mr. Margolis, do you want to reserve any time?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Okay, 5 minutes. All right, so you only have 10 minutes to cover 12 issues.
The feeling I'm going to focus a lot of my energy on a couple.
All right, you may proceed.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. I would like to spend almost my entire time discussing juror number 11, Juror Bill Zarian. I've been practicing law for 12 years in Clark County. I've never once had this experience, and it is an extraordinary one. I have never seen a case in which, in the middle of evidence, a juror arose with a question and proceeded to offer to compensate each of the victims that he had heard testimony from thus far with cash money. Now, on the one hand, I, as a criminal defense attorney, am well aware of the fact that sympathy for victims of crime is an absolutely human emotion. And even as a criminal defense attorney, I myself have sympathy for victims of crime. The thing that I find difficult about Judge Bluth's decision in not removing Juror Bilzerian is very simple. I find it very difficult to believe that Juror Bilzerian could have accrued the great deal of sympathy, the largesse and gratitude, and purely altruistic motive to compensate victims to the tune of thousands of dollars, a number of them, but seemingly at the same time had no corresponding antipathy for or prejudice against the individual presumably to have caused all of those losses. Now, it is certainly possible that Juror Bilzerian has the ability to compartmentalize issues in ways far more profound than the average human being. That being said, we need to understand that when we have the inference of bias raised, that mere assertions of impartiality by that juror are not enough to foreclose the issue, no matter how vociferous those assertions may be.
Counsel, if I may interrupt, in the briefing and just now you referenced the inference of bias.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't this juror's statement that he wanted to compensate victims $2,000 for losses mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. he determined they mm-hmm. had occasioned, wouldn't that have been a demonstration of actual bias such that he had predetermined before the close of evidence that they were victims? Doesn't the state have to prove two things in every case, that a crime has occurred and that the defendant was the person who committed that crime?
I'd like to think so, Justice Westbrook, and if you believe the briefing and what we've read thus far proffered by the state, the seeming fact is that his assertions to the contrary, Juror Bilzerian's assertions to the contrary, eliminate the existence of the actual bias, because he said, and I quote, "These are entirely separate. It is nothing related to my appraisal of this man and his apparent guilt or innocence, as the case may be."
So are you conceding then that he did not prejudge the issue?
Oh, no, I believe he actually, I believe he absolutely did.
Are you conceding that he did not prejudge the issue that these victims were victims, that crimes had occurred?
I think he absolutely prejudged the idea that crimes had occurred, and quite frankly.
So why isn't that actual bias?
Because I believe his assertions to the contrary were accepted by the judge. I was not the trial lawyer there. I still believe that it's actual bias, but ultimately, I wanted to focus a little bit on the inference of bias, because once the inference of bias is so severe as it is here, and I felt sympathy for a number of people, as have met everyone in this room has felt sympathy for victims of crime, but none of us have sua sponte arisen, especially when sitting in a jury on said trial for said crimes, to volunteer compensation to the victims. I believe that there is a corresponding feeling of antipathy toward the defendant and a feeling of responsibility, because I know that when I am done a wrong, or when someone I care about is wronged by someone, I not only want to cure the ill that has been visited upon them, I also feel some animosity, some antipathy toward the individual that occasioned that loss. And Juror Bilzerian apparently asserted to the satisfaction of the trial court that they were entirely separate. Now, I personally don't believe that. I don't believe it. However, I think that even if actual bias was foreclosed by the trial court, I still believe that there was an abuse of discretion, if not plain error, when the inference of bias had arisen that was so severe. As I said, 12 years of practice, I've never seen anything like this. And the assertions to the contrary were simply insufficient to overwhelm that inference of bias. As I say, I believe there was actual bias. I believe it's plain error, and I believe that the Tinsley case in the state of Nevada makes plain that one juror is all you need to take away a fair and impartial jury. And once you've done that, you've undermined due process.
So you're saying plain error. Are you conceding then that this was not objected to? I mean, plain error generally only applies if the party has not objected.
Many of the errors that were briefed were not complained of. In terms of Juror Bilzerian, they were complained of vociferously, loudly, and ultimately to the point that the zealous representation of trial counsel actually hurt Mr. Young, hurt the appellant. Much is made of the second assertion of error with respect to the trial court's quote-unquote failure to stop trial counsel from challenging the assertions of impartiality proffered by Juror Bilzerian before other jurors. Okay, that was discussed at length. And while I certainly empathize with counsel, I empathize more with Mr. Young. If I had been in trial counsel's position, I would have similarly found it difficult not to pound the table and say that his impartiality and bias is plain as day. How can you not see it? How can one possibly separate those two things?
But isn't the error preserved then if he objected to Bilzerian being on the jury?
I believe those errors are, but I also want to address the plain errors.
The remedy... Counsel at trial asked for was a mistrial. That's all counsel ever asked for.
I believe in his zealous, he can't be impartial we'll call it a little bit of an outburst, prior to the jurors being cleared from the room. I would suggest that that was a pretty strenuous objection, admittedly not couched in the proper manner. Okay. Well,
and didn't Judge Bluth actually offer the excuse of one juror, excusal of the juror, as an alternative to a mistrial? And didn't counsel then say if the court felt that that remedied it, he could understand?
Maybe
thereby
he,
preserving the...
Maybe he could. I can't. I mean, an alternate juror was there. It should have been done without the need for any specific request. When you ask for a mistrial, you've made plain that you believe that this jury is no longer fair and impartial. And Mr. Fisher did that in spades. He also pointed out that the juror in question was a YouTube celebrity. The fact remains that not all of us are gifted with the same abilities of persuasion, the same gift of gab. This individual quite literally makes his money by selling his opinions in video form online. I submit that maybe, just maybe, the offer to compensate all of these victims wasn't pure sympathetic altruism. In fact, if I were to follow up with the victims in this case, my guess is they did not receive thousands of dollars from this individual. I think that this man was allowed to hijack this trial. I think he was allowed to hijack it by this judge. Right, and I tried the remaining
Margolis,
portion.
We do have to stick with the record. So, I mean, we can't go any farther on this. There was nothing brought out about him having some other motive because of his career being on YouTube.
I feel like it's plain error. I feel like this, him being on the jury, period, is plain error. There have been, I believe that there is, if not actual bias, I believe there's a very, very strong inference of bias that is severe here. I do believe that there is actual bias.
So, sir, if there's just implicit bias, what is the remedy? Is that sufficient, or can we consider harmless error because of other evidence?
No, it is not harmless error. The Tinsley case in this state makes very plain that the presence of simply one biased juror is enough to taint a jury. Now, the state relies upon Hernandez, where three jurors bought a gift for the victim of for the daughter of a murdered victim or the child of a murdered victim. Okay, I want to point out what I feel is the primary way in which I would distinguish that case from the case of appellant Mr. Young, and I think it's not what was in necessarily briefed as heavily. The gift was purchased following the finding of guilt being entered, but only prior to the disposition of sentence. This happened in the middle of the state's case in chief. In the middle of the state's case in chief.
So in Hernandez, the jury had found the person guilty of first-degree murder, was on a break for a couple days. The jurors got together, bought a gift, and then it came out before they started the penalty phase deliberation, actually the penalty phase of the case, and the judge said, well, we'll wait till the end of the trial. Do you know where that gift was during the penalty deliberations? The appellant said it was sitting there in the jury room. And the Supreme Court said they were persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no prejudice, even though the gift was actually purchased. In this case, the juror disclosed that he was thinking about it, asked for permission, and then was told it was inappropriate, and he never did it. So if you actually go out and do it, you can have beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless. But if you only think about it, you can't do that.
I think the mere thinking about it, I think that Hernandez was wrongly decided regardless, but I do like to point out the difference in timing. I understand what the justices are saying. I think Hernandez was wrongly decided. I think this bias speaks for itself. 12 years of practice, it hasn't happened to me, and I would hasten to guess that it hasn't happened to the other trial attorneys in this room either. With that, I will wait for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Margolis. We'll go to the respondent's side, Mr. Okay. All right, Mr. Brooks.
May it please the court. The first thing I just kind of wanted to correct, and it's a small issue, was that a juror rose in the middle of the trial. That's not what occurred. A juror wrote a note and gave it to the marshal. No other member of the juror, of the jury ever heard anything about this. So this is contained to just Mr. Dan Blazarian.
Then shouldn't he have been perhaps removed based on bias if that is in fact demonstrated? Or do you think that there is no implicit bias in this case?
So you've used the word implicit bias. And so,
or bias or actual.
Well, I'll first address the implicit or implied bias, or bias in bias as a matter of law, which
right. the appellant actually only argued the inferred bias and didn't argue the actual or the implied bias.
I agree, and when Justice Westbrook asked the question about actual bias, it did raise an eyebrow to me because that wasn't actually what was argued, and that's probably because when you look at the canvas and the transcript, because if we're in the realm of actual bias, we would stay in the realm of what did the juror actually say, and did he demonstrate words that were some sort of partiality? And when you look at that transcript, there is nothing in that transcript that demonstrates the ability to not follow his oath or follow the instructions.
But counsel, in every case, the state has to prove two things: that a crime was committed and that the defendant was the person who committed the crime, correct?
Correct.
And so in this case, hadn't the juror already formed an opinion that a crime had been committed by watching the videos? He agreed with each of the victims that they were victims of crimes and that they deserved compensation. Isn't that prejudging part of the state's case before the state had finished and closed?
So good question. And we've used the word compensate or reimburse today, but that's not what actually his note and what he was saying. And when you actually look at his words, and when looking at it again today, I'm kind of reviewing it, I'm seeing what he actually said. If you look at the first words out of his mouth, one of the real interesting things is he says, yeah, for me, it's nothing to do with the case. This is like, you know, poor old ladies. So, I mean, I could all the time, you know, it's like a week out of my life. So I feel I can do two things at once. That's it. I can be impartial and still want to, like, help people that have lost money.
So he agreed that they had lost money.
Absolutely, Judge. And there were 9 victims in this case, and they were all on video. This was not a situation where everyone, by that time, and as you saw from the trial transcript, we paraded in one after another victim and had video. That was never going to be in dispute because every one of them you could see in the video. And notably, this is also in appellant's brief, not a single one of those victims ever identified Mr. Young because they just had something taken. Mr. Young was not a part of what had occurred to them, and there was never an assertion that they didn't lose money. That was never part of it, and counsel actually concedes that when asked by the court.
I'm not sure that counsel actually did concede that. I believe the court attempted to get counsel to concede it, and then counsel basically said, I'm not going to tell the court what my theory of defense is.
Correct. That would be during the longer canvas when the court initially describes the note. That's earlier in the transcript. So when the court says, hey, this is what just occurred, and the parties talk briefly, and then she gives the Hernandez cite, that's when he concedes that.
So I would ask, how is Hernandez even relevant in this case, since Hernandez is a juror misconduct case and the only allegation that was ever made here is that it was bias?
I think that essentially what the respondent's brief did was go from bias in the context of juror misconduct, because there's no actual bias discussed. It's not implied bias, you know, by the actual definition. And so if we were in the realm of inferred bias, which is essentially what was argued, when you look at that and you look at the Saizada case and you look at the Torres case.
But the issue is Hernandez. I mean, Hernandez bias wasn't an issue. The court was not addressing bias. Would you agree?
Agreed.
The only issue was misconduct, the jurors discussing something prematurely before they'd reached their decision.
Yes. And those were jurors discussing. In this case, we have no discussion. We literally have a juror.
Right, but isn't there a different standard of review when you have jurors discussing matters in a case? You actually have to show that it's prejudicial. Whereas if you can show bias, that's essentially a structural error. Would you agree?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that in this context. One, I don't, I heard actual bias for the first time today, so I'm not going to really discuss that because I don't believe that essentially the record, you can point to a single point in the record where he says anything that is actually biased. His canvas is repeated, and if you actually look at the word choice, he uses the word loss. They don't have their medical cards. Lose, compassion, has nothing to do with him. People that are on hard times, when you actually look at the word choice that he says, he never says anything was taken. He never says anything about the other person, because what he's actually referring to is nothing more than video and these elderly victims that have lost something. And so in the realm of inferred bias, it's not a situation where this juror's past personal life has experiences such that they're so close to the trial and the controversy that he's going to be seated on that you can use inferred bias to basically then kick him off.
So you didn't think he'd already reached a determination that these individuals were victims at the point that he offered to pay for their losses?
I think that they were in such a bad state in life, because when you actually see, and the judge, and that's why we have abuse of discretion, because the judge who sat there saw these women one after another. There's eight of them, and they are every bit of 80 and 70 years old. They can't fully hear. And so whether or not they had a loss, which you could see on video that they did, but whether or not they had no other means, it was tragic to see them. And this is a man who, we talk about $2,000, but $2,000 to him doesn't actually demonstrate bias. This is a multimillionaire who says that in the voir dire, and so that is a lot different than me giving $2,000.
Well, Mr. Brooks, can we just back up for a minute? Sure. Do we have a legal definition of inferred bias in the state of Nevada?
Yes.
What is it, and what are you relying on?
So I believe it actually was Justice Westbrook who argued that case, which was the Sayedzada case that was taking the Torres as the Second Circuit case that set forth that inferred bias. And then in the Sayedzada case, Justice Westbrook, when arguing, essentially gets it so that now it's in Nevada.
Okay. So what's the definition?
So inferred bias is a situation where a juror discloses a fact that bespeaks of a partiality sufficiently significant to warrant granting the trial judge discretion to excuse the juror for cause. Now, one of the interesting things is in both, and I can't remember if it's in Torres or if it's in Sayedzada, at the end of it, it says the trial court didn't err by excusing this juror, but we don't necessarily find that they had to have. And when you look at Torres, that was a situation where it was very complicated because it was a structuring case. And so it was money structuring. And the juror herself have been sitting there during this highly technical trial and thinking, oh my, it's a lot like what I did, and couldn't have compartmentalized possibly her own guilt to what she was hearing. Now, in the Sayedzada case, it was a credit card situation where the victim or the person on trial was a credit card type thief, and this victim had it. Now, I believe that Justice Westbrook's best arguments were when she is saying, what are you talking about? They said that they'd have to hear from the defense and all that stuff, but still.
Well, we've got it. Are you suggesting there's some sort of, you know, I don't know if I'm using the right word, but some level or scope of inferred bias? I mean, when could we ever have inferred bias that would necessitate removal of a juror? Under what circumstances?
When that juror says things a lot like what was said in Sayedzada, it makes me angry. It makes me mad. I don't know if I could be impartial. I could be biased. The defense attorney's role is to get the client off the hook, and a truly innocent person would personally state their case. That was essentially, and then the holding is inferred bias was there because the juror's similar experiences would have prevented her from deciding objectively. When you look at the transcript in this, there is no actual bias stated.
So my concern with the statement that there's no actual bias, if you look at NRS 16050, which discusses challenges for cause, and subsection 1F You can challenge somebody for cause if they've formed or expressed an unqualified opinion or belief as to the merits of the action. And in this case, this individual clearly felt that these victims were victims of crime. And in Valdez versus State, the Supreme Court said, when a juror prematurely forms an opinion in a case, the burden shifts to the defendant to change the juror's opinion, which violates the defendant's right to an impartial jury. I don't know why we're talking about inferred bias when we seem to have a situation where the juror came to a conclusion that these people were all victims.
These people.
Well, I think we're talking about that because that's what appellant raised in his brief.
Yeah, but these people just lost money. They aren't necessarily victims of Andrew Young. And none of them say it. And when you hear juror 11 pushed again on appellant's appendix 1119, for me, I didn't. That he's asked why they didn't. He didn't do it on his own. Line three. So you know, the one lady's got $3 to her name. She lost all her information. It's not so much about the money. It's just, you know, she's in the middle of a pandemic, doesn't have her medical cards. Whatever I mean.
And my concern is that the court then went ahead and said. You hear it in almost every closing argument, right? The state has to prove two things beyond a reasonable doubt. Was a crime committed, and who was it, in fact, that committed the crime? So I don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we've seen video with almost every single victim that somebody stole their things, whether it be $30 or a wallet. So we see crimes are being committed. And she subsequently, this we're at page 1126 in the record, volume 6, now, I see where you're going because he's saying, yeah, the crime's already been committed. And the court makes the determination at that point that this is more of an ID case and tries to get counsel to concede this. But the court recognized at the point that she's saying there's no bias, that this juror had already reached a conclusion that crimes had been committed because the court apparently also agreed that crimes had been committed. Which was, the court also recognized was the state's burden.
But this is the reason why, and I didn't really fully appreciate the abuse of discretion standard, to be honest, until kind of looking at this. This is the reason that a three-dimensional judge who's there in the courtroom and sees these three-dimensional victims in the videos, this wasn't a question. The video had been shown. But when you actually, she's the one who's talking to Mr. Bilzerian, and you can't fake diction, because when you and I are speaking right now, I'm not thinking about that. When you see also on 1120 and he says, if someone lose their wallet, I'd feel, you know, compassion for them, help them out, help out homeless people. It got nothing to do really with the court case. It's just, you know, people that are on hard times. That's it. He's not demonstrating that he's reached an opinion. He says that he can remain fair and impartial and wait.
But Mr. Brooks, it concerns me in the case law that we do have on inferred bias that there is a suggestion that the person has to be angry or upset or say, I can't hear this case, it's just too much for me, versus somebody in the situation we have here who is very kind and sympathetic and I'm trying to do the right thing. Why do we have inferred bias in one situation and not the other? Is it just the demeanor of the person, the juror, that should control? And how do we know? How can we be confident that there is not inferred bias in the situation presented by the facts here?
Well, first, because the trial judge is the one who's actually talking to him and making that discretionary call. But moreover, I think one of the things, and it happened in the earlier part of the argument, is that we're conflating inferring bias to a human being from the standard of inferred bias. The standard of inferred bias isn't this situation where we have someone who's saying everything that he can remain fair and impartial, but you also offered money, so I'm going to infer bias onto Mr. Young. That's not every inferred bias case is inferred on that particular person based on their past, their circumstances, and I shouldn't say every, I don't know if it was every, each one that I have read, I'm sorry, that their past circumstances make it such that they can't sit in this type of case because it would be too close to them as a person. Because the canvas controls in the context of the actual words, if we're in that realm of actual bias, because I don't know if there's anything that is inferred to his life experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Mr. Margolis, you may proceed.
Thank you. Feels to me like, to both the state and to the trial judge, anything short of Mr. Bilzerian saying, I can't be fair because I feel sorry for these folks, is going to fall short of the standard. And that just doesn't seem like it can possibly be correct. Whether we characterize it as a loss or someone being stolen from, it's very clear. The conclusion is that a crime was committed. None of these witnesses got up and said, I entered the Walmart, and when I left, my wallet wasn't there. I must have misplaced it. None of them entered the elevator at the casino and said, oh, I had my wallet and now I don't. I must have dropped it. I'm just a senior citizen with lapses in memory. That's not what happened. So while I believe there's actual bias, I think the inference of bias is so severe that any lip service that Juror Bilzerian paid to his altruistic generosity to humankind during COVID, especially if they're of a certain age, is a little bit overplayed and obviously a lot self-serving. The juror that says that they are so compelled to acknowledge that they don't know that they can be fair might in fact be having a psychological post-traumatic stress disorder type reaction to the things that they are seeing. Clearly, Juror Bilzerian was not having that. At least I don't believe so.
Right, but didn't the juror say that he's helped a lot of other people, including homeless people? And he didn't refer to these people as victims. He said people had suffered losses. He didn't say that they were crime victims. He said they suffered losses.
Well, I understand, Justice Gibbon. Does that not seem self-serving if you're sitting in Mr. Young's seat? Because to me, it really does. And do we have any evidence that substantiates that? Or do we just take everything the juror says, in spite of evidence to the contrary, as gospel truth and unassailable? Because as counsel for defendants and appellants, I clearly can't do that. I think actions speak louder than words. We've all heard that adage. I used to talk about it when I taught history before I became an attorney. Actions speak louder than words. He understood what he was doing when he sent that question.
Isn't that the Hernandez case? You actually had actions, and in this case, we had words. So somehow, if you think it, it's worse than if you do it?
No, I and think, not but I think don't think it, that you have to do
you
it.
You disclose it, and you ask permission. And in Hernandez, it's the opposite. And then it's the most important decision that any juror will ever make. Does someone live or die?
So the court's position is that the Hernandez case was about bias?
No, it's a different factual situation, as you pointed out. There's no doubt about it. But what actually happened is very similar. Here, the juror wanted to give something to these people out of sympathy. And in Hernandez, they not only wanted to do that, they talked about it, and then they did it. And then they were allowed to go on with jury deliberation for life and death as the decision. Why weren't those jurors excused? One of those jurors was an alternate, even.
Those jurors should have been excused, Your Honor. Those jurors should have been excused. Two wrongs don't make a right, and a bad precedent shouldn't be followed. The fact that Juror Bilzerian didn't act on the misconduct
doesn't... But isn't that why, as Mr. Brooks pointed out, why district courts have discretion? They're dealing with the circumstance. They've seen the person up front. They've had the reaction to them throughout the whole trial, jury selection, then during this part of the trial when this happened. That judge is in the best position to evaluate whether this juror is biased at that point in time, and it's an abuse of discretion call.
But can the sympathy be felt independent of a partiality?
The Supreme Court said Hernandez, sympathy is okay. It's understandable. Who wouldn't have sympathy for the murder victim's daughter? In this case, who wouldn't have sympathy for these older people that lost things important to them?
And I conceded in my opening that it's perfectly understandable, commonsensical, and even we defense attorneys feel sympathy for victims of crime. But when you are an impaneled juror in the middle of the evidence phase of the guilt part of a trial, I think you might be held to a higher standard if you really read your oath to pretty carefully.
Right. And the question was, would he still follow his oath? That's what the judge finally decided, and that he would.
I think he's getting the benefit of every doubt, and I think jurisprudentially, the appellant, a defendant on trial for multiple consecutive life sentences, should be getting that doubt. I think the tie should go to the runner, and Mr. Young is the runner.
Okay. With that, I'll thank you. We've concluded the argument here on this rather contentious case.